Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to New Books in Sociology, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Rituparna, and today I'm going to be in conversation with Dolly Kecon and Joel Rodriguez. Dolly Kecon is an anthropologist whose work focuses on the political economy of extractive resources, militarization, migration, indigeneity, food cultures, and human rights in India. She is the author of Life and Dignity, Women's Testimonies of Sexual Violence in Dimapur, Nagaland, 2015, Living with Oil and Coal, Resource Politics and Militarization in Northeast India, 2019, Leaving the Land, Indigenous Migration and Effective Labor in India, 2019, Ceasefire City, Militarism, Capitalism and Urbanism in Dimapur, 2021, and Seeds and Food Sovereignty, Eastern Himalayan Experiences, 2023. Joel Rodriguez is the author of Seeds and Food Sovereignty, Eastern Himalayan Experiences, 2023. He's a doctoral researcher at the Department of Social Anthropology, Stockholm University. His writings have been featured in Gastronomica, Morang Express, and Riot.in. His peace research work engages with law, violence, memory, food, and media. In today's conversation, we are going to discuss their recently published edited volume, Stories from the Heart, Food Journeys, that has been brought out by Zuban Books in 2023. Dolly and Joel, I welcome you to this conversation with NBN. Thank you so much for giving us the time and opportunity.
Thank you. Thank you for having us, Rituparna.
Right. So let me actually begin with this question about the context in which this edited volume came together. What was the need? And, you know, could you talk about the context?
Yeah. This is a project, I would say, a book project that came out of a very, very long conversation about food that Joel and I had been having for many, many years. And I think the pandemic in 2021, when Australia shut down from the world and I was stuck in Melbourne without seeing my family, my friends and my loved ones for 2 years, really triggered my longing for home, my, of course, longing for food and all the connections that was there in the Northeast. And I realized that Joel was also in a very similar place. I'll give him the time to talk about his journey, how this came about, but as somebody who was here in Guwahati, connecting with me, I think this conversation then became something concrete. And one day, I think when I was going for a walk in the park, like all projects start, you know, just through conversations, I suggested, how about writing all the stories that we are discussing and offering an invitation to different writers. How would that be? And I think Joel was very, very generous. And he said, I'm on. Let's see how this is going to pan out. So to answer your question about the context, it was definitely the pandemic. It was definitely 2021. And also it was around a time when food became so central in conversation, especially in the context of India. I had families in Nagaland, in Assam, and all across who were even struggling to buy potatoes and rice. There was a shutdown of the market. And then we began to see how, especially in the hills, especially places like Nagaland or Arunachal Pradesh and all, our friends and our families and relatives were foraging in the, you know, in the wild, and we're starting kitchen gardens. So as much as the pandemic shut down the world, it also really opened up a space for us to think about, among many other things, life, loss, also about food and how do we nourish one another. So Joel, please come in about the context for you.
For me, the experience of the pandemic was very central in writing and collating this book, because it, for someone who is from Bombay, from Goa, and who was caught up in many ways in Guwahati, it made me think, what is the idea of home? Where do I feel home? Where do I feel safe? And it was here in the Northeast that I would rather be than anywhere else during the pandemic. And yet my home was a place I felt safe, as well as I felt very lonely at that time. And it was during many conversations that I was having with Dolly, long conversations over the phone. It just calmed me down several times and made me think that here I am, safe and sound, and yet struggling in so many ways. So the phone calls with Dolly is while we were thinking about what would we do when the pandemic is over, or when the pandemic subsides in some way. And it's part of the many dreams that we dreamt together during a time like pandemic, that one of them was this book. So the journey of the book is through the pandemic and through the longings that I had of the food that I missed being locked up in a place. Because as it happens in the Northeast, your friends, your extended families are constantly sending you lots of food from all directions, from all the states, from different families, from different communities. And sitting in Guwahati, I have the privilege of tasting them all. And during the pandemic, somehow that channel was cut off. And I was there longing for food, for the herbs, for things that are prepared in people's kitchen gardens and their homes, in a place of love, in a place of solidarity, a communion of sorts. I think these were my initial reflections and the motivation to get this book together.
Thank you to both of you for beautifully laying out the context. And my next question is sort of a follow-up, because you're talking about food journeys from the Northeast. So is there something called Northeastern food?
Thank you, Rituparna. This is such an important question for us. I think both as social scientists, as people from the region, as people who study the region, I remember as a student, this question has been there, for quite a number of, a couple of decades, and it continues to emerge in mostly, I would say, academic conversations. And I think I am very aware that I'm underlining academic and intellectual conversations. And it also perhaps holds a mirror to what is it in the world of research that we intellectualize and that we debate about. Because if we take this question, which is a very important one for us as researchers, as thinkers, as writers from the region, if we take this question out of that world, for everyone else, the people who work in the Northeast Frontier Railways, the people who work in the Northeast Council, it's a done thing, right? It is both a directional and both I think, a process of understanding governance of a very particular region. When armed forces come to the region, they do say that we are going to the Northeast. And many of the people that we meet, and when we ask them where it is, then they begin to specify Manipur, Nagaland, or Arunachal. When we meet government officials from other parts of India who have been posted here in the region, they say, oh, I was in the Northeast. When children from other parts of India grow up here, they seldom mention the name of the state. They often say, the opening line is, I grew up in the Northeast myself. So I think in this process of thinking about, is there a region called Northeast? I think for me at this stage, as somebody who's so devoted to the region in terms of field work, in terms of engagement and advocacy, I've come to a point where I would say yes, right? There is a place called, I think, Northeast India, and it is both an extractive region. It is both a region where there's a lot of out-migration. It is a region where Armed Forces Special SPAR Act is still very much present. It is a region where we are still overcoming the trauma of militarization. So I think that's the shared experience that brings a region very visible. The second amazing connection that you think and you link about Northeast food, I think it's really relevant, not only to this conversation, but also why this book exists. I may be not quite off the margin if I say that when it comes to a book like this, it's, I think, one of the first efforts. I know Hoyenhauser wrote about the Northeast food recipes, bringing it together. I think it was, yeah, it was published by Penguin. And then we have an amazing repository of Assamese writings on food, right? In Assamese language. But when it comes to the Northeast, when it comes to archiving everyday lives, including food, it's in the Assamese language because the written culture is very, very old in the Brahmaputra Valley. But in terms of the English writing, I think we were very, how can I say, both experimental and courageous to bring out this food so that we have a way to say that, listen, the idea of the Northeast and Northeast food is real. And what makes it real beyond the idea of direction and geography is thinking about a place of solidarity, thinking about a place of affection and connection. Right? First, we talk about diversity, but in the diversity, it is amazing how the stories, 23 stories that we brought together, are so much about connections as well. The Northeast food, I think, experience is real. Secondly, because it also allows us to recognize the international boundaries around this region. So if you look at Akur's piece, who wrote about his journey of eating fish as a Métis, you know, musician, thinker, he's going in search of his people through Assam into Bangladesh. And because he's from the Northeast, that he can connect both with this idea of the Métis diaspora in Bangladesh and also the connection with food. The second beautiful essay in this book that we saw, which actually is Northeast food kind of, you know, conversation that's happening, is Anjuman Ara Begum's work on Muri in the borderland. And she brings it so powerfully and beautifully about making Muri among the Muslim women community. And what does it mean for them? If we don't, I feel, as an anthropologist who work on food, if we don't recognize these stories as Northeast stories, I think we are also then rejecting the idea of the borderland and this exceptional space that we share, which sometimes we also call it the Eastern Himalayas. So, Jill, I'll ask you if you want to say anything or if you're okay with that.
I'll just summarize what Dolly has already said, that we understand that there is a space as Northeast food because food is so closely linked with our lived experiences every day. And thereby, food informs our culture and our culture is informed by food. It goes both ways. So you cannot separate this lived experiences, which is different from perhaps the rest of the country. And the communities here are still very closely connected to their land. These connections are reflected on how they treat food, how they are involved in the cultivation practices, how doing the kitchen garden is a collective experience that many people are raised within. Also, how the flavors always takes you back to home when you're away. So these experiences together the community's connection to land, which continues, and how it is reflected in their everyday, I think that is why there is a significant notion, there's a significant lived philosophy of Northeast food.
Right. My next question is kind of related because we're talking about, is there a need for a Northeast or a food, or is there something called Northeast food? So what was the need for a book on food from the region? And what role did both of your positionalities play in bringing this volume together, considering that both of you have different social, you know, identities?
I didn't think we, as editors, we look from the perspective of the need for a book of this nature. Instead, during our discussions, it was the solidarity that we have lived through and the shared experiences. These were the things that we were longing to tell through the stories that are in the book. So the idea did not come from a need for a book that on Northeast India, but it came from a place of fellowship and solidarity, and that is also very very central to my role in the book as someone who was born and raised in Bombay, and who came here to the Northeast for his to do his master's program. And who continue to remain here to live with so much joy and with so much of love. I think that is very central to my experience in the book. Dolly, you would like to add?
Sure, Ritupana, this is such a generous question about our positionalities and, you know, the need for a book on food from the Northeast. I think for me, as somebody who has written a lot about militarization, about human rights, you know, with a law background as such, I'm still learning to look around and acknowledge what else is there. Like I often shared with you, I am from Nagaland, but I feel that I almost know nothing about this region. It is so diverse. It has layers and layers of experiences. And so when I was thinking about this book, was there a need for it? I think, like Joel was saying about solidarities and love, I was approaching this book from a space of acknowledgement and acknowledging not only the people, the communities who cook, who share food, and who grow food for us, but also the plants. It is exceptional in terms of the biodiversity of the region, in terms of the plants we get and we eat, the fish mint, you know, pennywort. Where else do we eat those? You know, and just the richness of the seasonal food that's there. It is amazing that it should, I think, help us maybe to think about right here a methodology of humility and acknowledgement when we work on food on a region like Northeast India. I remember growing up as a child, every season I was on top of a tree, either the bogori tree, aam gas, different kinds, you know, looking at jungle berries, eating, often not even making it home before sunset in the summer. Now it's winter here, can't eat too much bogori, right? And the bogori gas is lined up across Brahmaputra Valley with both the paddy fields flanked on the right and the left. And the harvest, where else do you see a golden field ready to be harvested? And we see it, we devour it with our eyes as scholars, as people who work on the region, like Joel, who's adopted the region as home. But I was coming to write this book from a place of acknowledging, I think, the plants, the bogori, you know, the sawal, and, you know, all the lovely food that we have been eating, and how do we then begin to have that space? And I think that's where my positionality, perhaps as somebody from the region, as a Naga anthropologist, you know, played into it. And I think Joel also has been very, very gracious and generous sometimes, most of the time, I would say, to just indulge me in this madness of thinking that I have. So thank you, Joel.
I just remember this one story that Facebook threw up on my face a few days back about me going shopping in a place like Mysore more than a decade ago. So I was with my friend who is from Nagaland, and we were going to buy some groceries. And he told me the story. I mean, he told me that if he would go ahead and ask for the prices of the vegetables, he would have to pay extra. He would have to pay more than what I would pay. So he would ask me to go ahead and do the bargaining, ask for the price and buy the vegetables while he stood behind carrying the bags. And I said, why is this so? And I was so ignorant and dumb at that time. And then he said, this is called the skin tax. Or this is what amongst his friends, they call the skin tax. Because they are from the Northeast, they paid this skin tax on the prices of everything that they buy. And I had forgotten that story until Facebook threw up a few days back. And I think times like those and times like when I've heard these stories is what has informed my positionality over the years. Of course, one of the first academic readings from the Northeast that I did was all Dolly's writing. Once upon a time, I was so engulfed with everything that she wrote, and I wanted to read everything that she's ever written. And I think I did that. I have read everything that Dolly has ever written. And her lived experiences, her human rights experiences, where she's documented so many events, tragedies, violence at the grassroots as part of human rights organizations, and how she's brought it together. And the readings of many more amazing scholars from the region. I think that has informed my positionality, constantly telling myself that perhaps I don't know enough. Perhaps I don't know anything at all. So what I really need to do is sit down and listen with an open mind and acknowledge and cherish and work deeper and deeper in solidarity and fellowship.
I think that's very important to listen, and because we're talking about collaboration also in a way, and we also talked about stories. So I would want to know what role storytelling plays in this book.
Ritupana, you're asking amazing questions, so thank you very much. I think you'll have to edit a lot of this interview, I'm telling you. Joel and I are having the time of our life answering your beautiful questions. Storytelling is so important and is so integral to the world we come from. And I cannot stress enough, as an anthropologist, as an ethnographer, with amazing fellowship that I have with fellow sociologists and other political scientists who do field work, how do we understand what is theory? And I think we have been so far removed and so intimidated with the world of ideas, right? That it is still in a lot of the connections and conversations that I have with students, it is still so abstract that one, students are constantly hiding behind literature reviews, particularly the students from the region who come. And the voices really take time to come out. Storytelling is so integral to everything, including reporting, including the theories that we make of the world, the ideas as to the world around us. Recently, I think last year, I wrote this small piece for the seminar called Stories as Theories. And it came from, I think, one of the most scathing, horrible reviews of my book, Living with Oil and Coal. And I'm okay with critics, but the fact that, you know, certain readers trash it as just nothing but full of stories really is revealing, is telling. Because I think even in the world of research, we really don't know the value and the depth of what stories can do. And particularly for indigenous cultures. And we look at writings from Australia, from New Zealand, from First Nations communities in North America, from Latin America, from different parts of Africa. Rituparna, stories are so important to show us a world that's out there. Guwahati, I'm speaking about this book from Guwahati. How did the name come about? It's the place. It was the Garden of Betel Nuts, Tamul. Right? I'm looking at the name Kohima. Where did it come? It was the name of a plant, a flower in the Tenidia language. Right? Look at the places we have. Right, Humologuri, Jalukbari. Guwahati is filled with suburbs named after plants. So today, when we have urban studies at its height, and we have so many smart students coming to study the city of Guwahati, what can stories tell us? And I think you so wisely put that word about listening and how do we listen. I think if we have to be sharp scholars and think about theory, we have to learn to listen. And perhaps we are really at a point in time, especially when we are writing about the Northeast, at a very good point where there's a space of generosity, a space to experiment, a space to allow one another to listen, to share, that we can, I think, really, really think about story and storytelling, not as something dumb, right? Because if we say the storytelling is dumb, we are, in fact, erasing our entire history that our ancestors kept it for us to say, you know, does it mean that my Naga ancestors were so dumb and stupid that all they had was oral culture and they were not smart? That's not true, right? The Naga Hills, the way they defended the Naga Hills and they fought against the Britishers is recorded. And it says that they defended the Naga Hills for almost 47, close to 50 years. They were not dumb people. So I refuse, in a sense, I think it's also the rejection, right? It's also the rejection of me as a thinker, as a writer, to say that we just put storytelling in a basket, in a dustbin, and then we prioritize Foucault. No offense to Foucault. I'm very happy students without Foucault and prioritize Elizabeth Povenelli. And we wobble and we ramble in that world of abstraction where many of us, sorry, unlike Walter Benjamin, will not walk down the boulevards of Paris, right? I will walk down the roads of Kargoli and I will walk down the roads of Ulaanbaatar to buy masks in the morning. How do I theorize that? I think we need that kind of courage and honesty as scholars, as thinkers, to respect the people who live here if we have to, I think, continue to write about the region. Joe, please come in. You have to say something.
You have to unmute yourself.
I don't think I have anything to add. And Dolly has summarized everything so beautifully. So I will just let it be.
Yeah, I think, you know, I don't want to edit anything. It's been fabulous listening to both of you. And Dolly, it's not an appropriate platform, but Joel has already said, like him, I also read everything you write. And, you know, I'm a huge fan. And yeah, it's also interesting how you talk about storytelling and it being dismissed, because primarily as ethnographers, I think that's something we always face in terms of, you know, the authenticity of our research in that sense. I have to also ask now some questions about how issues of food are looked at it in the book, and as editors you'll have a bird's eye view. So you know, how does food determine domestic relationships and identity, both questions being very important in the Northeastern region?
I think it's a very difficult question. And it can be also a painful question to ask. When we started the journey of the book and when we invited people to write, we did not give them a structure or a framework to work within with. And yet, I think very central to the what people have written and how they have, in a way, told their stories from their heart and from their soul, this domestic relationship and identity is always there, and it's quite central to many of the writings. Let me read a rather long piece from, extract from what Chani has written as someone from the younger generation from the region, and how she sees her identity intertwined with the dynamics of food in her culture. She writes, "My childhood memories are far removed from the land, but not from food. I grew up running around car-ridden streets and manicured parks. The only land I toiled in was the sandpit in the playground. When I joined my mom in her garden, the various creatures that accompanied her attacked me and left me with rashes, as if smelling my inexperience with the soil. but food was everywhere, in the cafes and restaurants I frequented with friends, the snacks I prepared every time I hosted friends at home, at potlucks where I cooked and ate more than the previous day's meal. Lunchtime at school meant a rush to get in line for a sliver of pizza, a boxed pad thai, or an overpriced sandwich from the restaurants nearby. When my friends and I cooked together, I always wanted to try a new recipe. How about a lasagna or a burrito bowl? These experiences have shaped my taste today, and the food I enjoy is now far removed from our land. Growing up outside Mizoram exposed me to food that I try to find in the state today, in the grocery stores that are attuned to my globalized taste. I think these new experiences like Chinese are also very significant to how we see identity intertwined with food. And all of us are constantly negotiating and renegotiating and discovering and rediscovering our own associations of how we see food in everyday life. Similarly, Sangeeta Tete also writes about how during her childhood, her family mainly ate rice and leafy vegetables. And these leafy vegetables were grown in their kitchen gardens or collected from the forest. And there was a variety of vegetables in their paddy fields, riversides, and jungles. And with every different season of the year, they had different vegetables to forage from, to grow and to eat. And this is one of her primary memories of how she remembers her mother and her relationship with food. And without romanticizing it too much, she writes, "It did not cost anything. We did not need money to spend. Buying dal would cost a lot. In order to save a bit, we used the leaves mixed with rice starch as staple at home." And yeah, these are some of the experiences that are in the book, which speak of domestic relationships and identity. And for me also, as growing up in a house filled with domestic violence, I was very hesitant to cook for myself or anyone else, because every time the food was not perfect according to my father's standards, we would have a fight at home. We would have physical violence. We would have sexual violence. And you did not know when this would stop. And when I started living alone by myself, I was so scared to cook. But I realized that as a small boy who was always standing at the door of the kitchen because I was not allowed to enter the kitchen, I would have these mental notes of what my mother would put in the pot and when and how long did every step take. And over the years and years, I think they had all collated to the point when I was living alone and it all burst through my hands, through my mind, through my soul of let's try all of these dishes that my mother prepared. And that is how it started, from this intense fear of cooking ever in my life, not knowing who would bounce on me, who would physically hit me for not being good enough. And there it was, the first people that I actually cooked for are for my friends from the Northeast, who no matter what I cooked were very appreciative, were very loving and very kind. And I think it is from there that I got the confidence to now cook for bigger crowds, for bigger communities, and for everyone I love. And that's the joy that cooking has finally healed a part of me very significantly. I think I've spoken enough. I think Dolly should come in here.
I will only come in here to tell Rituparna and all the listeners that Joel bakes the most amazing sopatel, and he comes to the kitchen and all our amazing conversations take place there. And so he's been very, very generous as a dear, dear friend, as a fellow anthropologist, ethnographer, And I have nothing more to add. I think this moment that he shared, I think, is very poignant and should make us think. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm really sorry that you had to go through something like that in your childhood and adolescence. And it also makes me actually think about the relationship that food has with memories, nostalgia, and sometimes even bad incidents. This is where, you know, probably you one can also change how memories are from being bitter to good ones. And this is also through food and the people and the relationships that, you know, you build over time. So, you know, I also want to know this relationship between food and memory, because it's very intricate. And how does this come out in the book?
That's, I think, you know, that's such a special question. I'm really looking at the book, even as we are talking in this fabulous podcast. And one person who comes to my mind among all the wonderful contributors in this book that I bowed on to is Jenny Spariot's essay. And I am amazed that she took the time to write this piece for Joel and my book. It's titled Hills, Plains, and the World, Alive in Meals and Morsels. And it's about her journey, her memory of growing up in the tea plantations of Assam. Her father worked in tea, and she recollects her childhood eating continental food, like many of the plantation families in Assam, and the world that she was opened up to through her grandmother and her taste of porridge, something as simple as that. And for Jenny's period, her comfort food is porridge. And I think the memory that we have with food is not only food. It's like a doorway that opens up our present to a past of relationship, to a past sometimes, which is very painful and violent, like Joel was sharing with us. But it's only by going to those moments can we find the courage to heal and come back to the present and find a generous space to write about it and then move forward. Because in writing about that, we also are forging a community. So Rituparna, during the, I think, beginning of this podcast, you were talking about your journey as a sociologist who works exceptional pieces on food and I think thinks about food as well. And I think that moment, I felt that we were all part of a community. And so in terms of food and memory, Jenny Spariot's piece really spoke about the connection. The other piece that came to my mind is Nivi Kotso's piece. And I'm thrilled that we have a Naga male writer and a scientist who writes prose. I think very, very few people in the world of science can bridge into the world of prose and write. And he's somebody that we should look out for as a writer, as a thinker from the region. And he writes about his journey with rice beer. And as a Naga feminist, it is an astounding piece that is going to stay with us for many, many decades to come, because I feel that for the first time, we have a Naga male writer and a thinker who is calling out hypocrisy in Naga society, who is calling out the idea of violence that families go through. And his piece is about his mother who brewed rice beer in Kohima for the family so that he could study, he could go to school. And that's a journey both of memory, but also a journey of politics and a journey of calling for justice and a journey of holding a mirror to our face about what it means to talk about inequality among indigenous communities. Because I think we're in a danger in terms of food and memory where we are obliterating a very complex conversation about inequality and, you know, about land as well. I think that's really important. The third part that I wanted to bring in was this piece that I also wrote in the introduction. And I call it Aunty Senti's Alu Chutney recipe. And I think this is an ode to my mom as well. You know, one of the connections that Joel and I have is a hard connection. And it's also because of the childhood experiences that we have had. As a feminist, I've always talked about family violence. I advocate very strongly for the elimination of gender violence in all societies because I grew up in one of them. And so I grew up with a single mother, and it was very difficult for my mom to cook. because she had to bring home the money. And so I was often, I think, eating in a neighbor's house, you know, growing up somewhere else, waiting for my mom at the gate so that she would come at sunset. So I think food was really important for me to think about it. And so when I got the chance to write, among all the things I wanted to write, I wanted to go back to my memory and present this Auntie Cynthia's aloo chutney as homage to single women, to migrants from rural areas who come to urban places like Dimapur, Guwahati, and how much they take up in terms of the space to care for us, to care for others, but are often eliminated and erased in this world of high theory when we have to theorize, you know, when we have to really talk about how smart that we should sound in the world of research. So I think the connection between food and memory, in short, is some of the reflections, you know, that I've just said. Joel, please come in, say something.
No, I don't think I have anything more to say.
Yeah, that's completely okay. I know that this conversation can go on for hours. And my last question, because this is an edited book, how do you look at the structure of the book? What thought process went behind, you know, the present structure as it emerged?
Yeah. As we mentioned before, that perhaps there was no structure. We wanted the book to showcase the solidarity and the shared experiences that we were longing to tell. And so the book is a book of fellowship that we are offering, a book of solidarity. And when everyone wrote it, and when we put the book together, yeah, there were certain strands, many of them really overlap. But if I am forced to answer to that and give a possible structure, there are few essays that at their core, they engage with the idea of Northeast food, or the idea of what is a food that is ethnically authentic to their own communities, and how the association with food is very closely linked to identity, to everyday lived experiences, and the moment of resurgence, the moment of revival in sorts. So there is a group of essays that would possibly come there. There are a group of essays where people are on this journey of life, and through the violence that they have faced, to the insults that they have faced, to the happy times that they have shared together, it has taken them on a journey of courage, of love, and fellowship. There are a group of essays that look as food and the taboos that are restrictions that are imposed on people subtly and sometimes too explicitly, and how that a different relationship with food. And while we are on these journeys, there are certain essays that are clearly telling us, hold on, don't have a romanticized version of food from the Northeast, because the moment you have recipes that are divorced from everyday lived realities, then you have something very incomplete. So whether it be in the tea gardens, whether it be during famine, whether it be during war, these are very important lived experiences that have informed how people eat today. Of course, there are a series of essays that look at food and nostalgia and going to a place with hope and dreams and living the life ahead. So we have essays from Hoinu Hozel, Techi Nimi, Amari Jamatia, Juliana, Gertrude and Sabrina, Yan Beni, Aku, Babina, Ningrechon, Tarun, Rini, Chani, Fuchum, Mebozo, Janice, Sangeeta Tete, Nivi, Anjuman, him, Kunga, Praveen, and RK. And there is one point I purposely missed out. We have 3 photo essays, and I think Dolly will speak about why we have these 3 photo essays and what do they speak of.
The photo essays are really beautiful, and we have an elaborate photo essays on food justice from Tarun Bharatiya, and it's on the hawkers of Shillong, right? How they feed the city and everyone around, and yet they have no space to sell the food. And it's so apparent even in Dimapur and even in Guwahati. And I would say that Guwahati is the biggest city in the Northeast, has the worst space for vendors, especially for female vendors. We are so proud of the food we eat, and yet when we talk about here to buy it, it's in a very, very horrible space next to a public bus stop, or, you know, where they are walking and the police is chasing them because they are quote unquote illegal. And so hopefully my prayer is that people who look at Tarun Bharatiya's photo essay on the street hawkers on social justice connect with that. The other chapter on food are actually two authors coming together, Fuchumbeni and Vives of Voro, and it's titled Cakes of Nagaland. And I hope that the readers enjoy it and also remember that cakes are so integral to us as communities, to indigenous people. It's not foreign. I think like biscuits were introduced by the colonial planters, like milk tea was introduced by the Sahibs. Cakes are so integral to us, birthdays, weddings. And so I just wanted to give that that idea. And I approached Joel with it. Joel in the beginning was a little confused as a dear IT collaborator from Goa and then who lived in Bombay. He was like, what are you talking about? How can it be Cakes of Nagaland? But I hope that, you know, when it comes to cakes and as Northeast food, the narrative will never be the same again. The third chapter is this beautiful photo essay by Kunga and Praveen, and it's from Sikkim, Darjeeling and Kalimpong area, and it's on food and it's on the sacred ceremonies of the Himalayan communities. It's very, very beautiful. I hope that you can, for the readers, have a look at that. I would like to give a shout out from Joel and my end for this book cover. So if you even Google Food Journey Stories from the Heart, you will see the most beautiful book cover. And it's from one of our contributors, Praveen Chetri, from Kalimpong. And these are yeasts to make fermented, rice beer. And I think that's the spirit that we are talking about. So thanks, Joel, for passing on the question to me. But I think that's where I'll end.
Thank you so much to both of you. This was such an engaging conversation. And I'm very sure that our listeners will now go back to picking up copies of your book and reading it. So thank you once again for giving me so much time.
Thank you, Rituparna.
Thank you, Rituparna.